On the Same Page, A Good Omens Fan Fiction by Chekhov, read by GorillasGal86. Part 8, Chapter 10. The night had been long and rather lonely. Following their conversation, Aziraphale hadn't the peace of mind about him to read anything, so instead he slid under the covers while Crowley showered. And by the time the man came out, he was already dozing. He felt the bed creak, and then nothing. Crowley did not edge closer. He did not attempt physical contact like the previous few nights. Instead, they lay parallel to each other in darkness, listening to the glass rattle as the wind whipped in from the mountains, sloughing snow against the windows. And that was fine. Aziraphale was fine with it. He did sleep fitfully, and he was plagued by the sensation that he'd been a coward and a fool to not discuss things outright. But that was what he deserved. "I'll talk to him in the morning," he thought to himself around 2 a.m., and then around 3, and then 4. Around 5 in the morning, he almost rolled over and shook Crowley awake, just about ready to yell, "What is it? Where is the limit? How much can I get away with before you hate me?" But he didn't. Instead, he tossed and turned until 6, read the news on his phone until 7, and then trudged off to take a shower and prepare for the Christmas service. At 9, he boarded the Dowling's vehicle and tried not to think about how he and Crowley hadn't spoken a word to each other all morning. Instead, he focused on the outing and the holiday cheer, and tried to convince himself it would be a welcome break, a nice change of scenery. The ride took a full hour, and they were nearly late because of how slippery the roads were. The town itself was pleasant enough, quaint and picturesque, with lovable American roadside attractions. It had a sizable Lutheran church, which the Dowlings seemed more or less familiar with. The attending people were just as quaint as the town itself, though it was possible they were normal by American standards. The service was lovely, and relatively short in comparison to Mass, but the pastor did go on some very questionable tangents of the right-wing variety, invoking the Apostle Peter, which immediately activated Aziraphale's old buried reflex to bring up the Book of Acts, which featured the same Peter in a very un-American act of striking a man dead for not participating in divine socialism. He resisted the urge, and then resisted the consequent urge to miss Crowley and lament the fact that, were they on normal speaking terms, this would be the perfect opportunity to lure the man into another one of his entertaining rants. By the time they'd returned to the house, around 2 in the afternoon, Aziraphale was just about ready to throw in the towel. He headed upstairs as soon as they returned, but still had to talk himself into opening the door to the bedroom, like he was sneaking back in after a guilty night out. All of his anxiety and uncertainty was so stacked on this single action that the inevitable anticlimax of the room being empty did not even occur to him as a possibility. Evidently, he was not the only one who had suffered an emotional breakdown, because judging by the state of things, Crowley had been stress cleaning. The floor was free of scattered socks. The suitcases had been pushed into the corner, and the bed was made and tucked in so tightly one might suspect the maid had done it. And perhaps given where they were staying, Aziraphale would have thought that much, if it wasn't for the festively wrapped black box on top of the pillow on his side. He approached, heart fluttering, and picked up the decorative card on top and flipped it open to read. It had merely a few lines scribbled on it, but the familiarity of the gesture was enough to wane some of his worries. Happy appropriated pagan solstice holiday. A. Curious, he untied the scarlet ribbon and slipped the top off, balancing it precariously on one arm. Inside, there seemed to be some sort of beige garment. It was folded in such a way that it was difficult to recognize, but it was suspiciously familiar. On top was another small card with the words, "Told you I could do it." Aziraphale's heart jumped excitedly into his throat before he'd even set the box down. When he lifted out the coat, for it was a coat, he couldn't contain the gasp before it was on his lips. "Oh, darling," he whispered to himself, inspecting the heirloom vintage he had kept in pristine condition ever since he'd acquired it, until a recent summertime trip down to the coast had gotten him and Crowley into a spot of trouble and had earned him a sizable stain of paint on the shoulder. That stain was gone now. It was good as new. Well, new as it could be, which was still well worn, but it was clean, as if the stain had never been there. He'd lamented about it the whole ride back to London. How had Crowley even known where he'd put it? When had he gone rifling through his stuff? The devil. But despite these multiple questions, and Crowley's indubitably shady methods of getting his way, the gesture had nonetheless sent Aziraphale into a weightless state of bliss comparable to how their kiss had made him feel, with none of the guilt. At the very least, Crowley wasn't mad. He still cared, at least in some small way, and it was enough to spur the tiny flicker of hope inside of Aziraphale's chest into a warm, crackling flame of courage. Fueled by this heat like a steam engine, Aziraphale headed off to find the man and thank him, and apologize, and perhaps even to talk if the first two went well enough to get that far. He was uncharacteristically optimistic, and despite his relatively impressive sleep deprivation, also rejuvenated as if nothing at all had been the matter. Much to his disappointment, Crowley was not in the downstairs living space, and he was not, apparently, in the upstairs lobby where the dartboards and pool tables were. He was not anywhere, in fact, and Aziraphale was beginning to worry until one of the staff informed him that Crowley had left a few hours prior and taken the car with him. "Did he see where he was going?" Aziraphale asked. "No," admitted the woman. "But he did ask us about ski resorts. Asked if there was a place to go snowboarding." Aziraphale frowned. "Is there?" "Sure, about 40 minutes from here," she replied. "The lifts won't be moving since it's Christmas Day, but there's an old man who minds the cabin there, lives alone. He has a snowmobile on him, and he usually gives rides up the mountain to those who can pay." "But he doesn't have a snowboard," protested Aziraphale to the woman, who merely shrugged as if to say, "How is that my problem?" "I imagine if old Bart took a liking to him, he might have unlocked the rental shop as well. It's a stretch, but he seemed pretty determined when he left." Feeling pacified for the moment, Aziraphale thanked her and went back upstairs. Not having Crowley there may have been a blessing in disguise. This gave him a chance to organize his thoughts and get all his ducks in a row. First, he pulled out his computer to get some work done and answer a few prying emails from Gabriel, and finally, around 3:30, sat down to write his feelings in a coherent manner. He did this on paper, if only for the physical satisfaction of tearing out each page and crumpling it when he found the lines inadequate. Before long, the entire fireplace was filled to the brim with tightly compressed white balls, and the light by which he was penning his melancholic iterations of, "My dearest Crowley, I know we have not exactly talked about this," and, "Crowley, my treasured platonic associate, It pains me to say this, but I am afraid I've been rather unclear with you regarding our pretend relationship. And, Crowley, you absolute fiend. With all due respect, what pray the fuck is going through your mind? Was becoming scarce. Finally, he tore out the last page of the spiral-bound notebook he had on him and looked up and through the window. The time was past 4, and the sun was going down over the line of trees on the horizon. Crowley was still not back. Now, that's not reason enough to panic yet. Thought his ear fail, and promptly began to panic anyway. He did so silently at first, standing up and pacing between the fireplace and the piano. Then he graduated onto muttering as he headed back into the main hall to peek out the front windows, hoping to spy familiar headlights approaching too fast. When this also failed, he went to fetch Harriet, who went to fetch the staff again, who went to fetch the groundskeeper to ask for the phone number of the old man who lived on the mountain. When they finally had it, the time was nearly 5. The first time they called, there was no answer, but the second time the line connected. An asthmatic, scratchy tone of an octogenarian graced the line. "Hello," he wheezed. "Bart, old pal, it's me," said the groundskeeper into the speakerphone. "Listen, I got a question for you. Didn't happen to have a man come by to use the mountain today, did you?" Old Bart coughed into the receiver once. "A man? Yeah. Now that you mention it. Did come by. Young guy." "How young?" Aziraphale asked impatiently. "Who's that?" Bart grunted. "You got a funny accent." "Just someone who's looking for his..." The groundskeeper scratched his head. "Husband," Aziraphale inserted, perhaps a bit testily, because he was running low on patience. "I'm looking for my husband, the man you saw. What did he look like?" There was a pause, and an almost audible shrug from the receiver.
A biker, I guess. Red hair, hippie-like, wore sunglasses."
Bart coughed again. "Took one of my boards and asked me to give him a lift up the trail." The party gathered around the phone exchanged a few looks. "When was that?" Aziraphale asked again.
"About 2 hours ago," said Bart. "Or 3. I was napping, so I wasn't really keeping track."
"So he's not back?" asked Harriet. The man on the other end of the line hummed.
"I told him just to leave the board against the door when he was done. Don't really know. I suppose I could check now. Give me a minute here, folks."
As the receiver clattered down on some unseen surface, Aziraphale took a deep breath. He was not ready to deal with this. He wasn't even sure where to start. What if Crowley had been hurt? What if he'd fallen and broken a limb? How were they going to find him? Who would they call? A painfully long 2 minutes later, and the other end of the line crackled with static again, and old Bart's chain-smoker voice returned.
"No board," he said shortly.
Harriet glanced up, saw Aziraphale pale visibly, and her eyes sharpened.
"What do you mean, no board?" she demanded in her let-me-speak-to-your-manager voice.
"No board that I can see," old Bart repeated. "It's windy as hell out there. Can't see much of anything, granted. But it don't look like he's back yet."
"But it's dark," Aziraphale choked out. "The sun set an hour ago. How can he not be back? Where is he? What if he's lost? What if he's..."
His chest tightened painfully and he took a step back, putting his hand over his mouth.
"I'll have to call the patrol," old Bart said, unaware of the mental breakdown happening on the other end of the line. "Might take some time, though. They can get down here in an hour, I reckon."
Aziraphale closed his eyes, beginning to shiver with dread. An hour was too long. It was Christmas Day.
People got hurt all throughout the holiday season. No doubt whatever emergency services were available at this time of year were busy. They were miles away from any hospital. It was pitch black, and Crowley was somewhere in the mountains. How could they find him? Where could they even start looking? What if it was already too late?
This can't be happening,
he thought numbly. It absolutely wasn't. This was a dream. This was a nightmare. He was going to wake up. He was going to wake up right now, damn it, and none of this would be real. Crowley would be back. He would be safe. Not. He screwed his eyes shut tightly.
Dear Lord, please, no.
He prayed.
Don't take him from me. Not him. Anything. Literally anything else.
Outside, there was a thud. Aziraphale's eyes burst open. Harriet and the groundskeeper were still gathered around the phone on the desk, saying something, but none of the words filtered through. Instead, as if compelled by some other force, he looked at the front door.
Please.
He begged again, silently. The door handle turned. Aziraphale was halfway across the room by the time Crowley stepped through. Without even allowing the other to get fully inside, he had his hands fisted in the man's jacket. A split second later, and he yanked Crowley into an embrace, crushing him tightly to his chest, not even caring about the noises of shocked protest and the snow shaken free from his hair.
Azira, what? Oh, thank God.
Aziraphale gasped, voice cracking at the edges.
You idiot! You absolute! You stupid!
He yanked Crowley away for a moment and grabbed his face instead. Crowley's eyes stared back at him from above the sunglasses, which had slid down his nose. His face was slightly red from windburn, but whole and unharmed.
I'm going to kill you.
Aziraphale choked out nasally and kissed him instead. Crowley made a startled noise into his mouth, but did not otherwise protest. For a moment they pressed close, and then Aziraphale pulled away again, leaving them both slightly more pink than before and absolutely flabbergasted. For someone who had initiated the action for the second time, Aziraphale seemed no less qualified to explain why he'd done it. Crowley, for the equal number of times he'd been on the receiving end of such rash decisions, was similarly uncertain of how to react to them.
Right then,
he choked out.
Hello.
Aziraphale's jaw tightened and his mind abruptly recalibrated. Try again. The gears in Crowley's head seemed to be turning.
Sorry,
he ventured.
You better be.
Aziraphale snapped, finally releasing him from his iron grip and firing up his most scalding glare instead.
What were you thinking? Going out onto the mountain by yourself on a public holiday? Do you have a death wish? No, I just thought I'd get a run-in.
The realization that he was in trouble seemed to be properly dawning on him.
The guy at the bottom gave me a board and a lift on a snowmobile.
Yes, we know. Aziraphale was now vibrating from a cocktail of excess adrenaline and relief. And when we called him, he said you still hadn't returned the snowboard. The sun set an hour ago. Crowley shifted from one foot to another, appropriately sheepish for once in his life.
Yeah, I kind of lost it.
He paused, and when Aziraphale said nothing else, kept going.
See, everything was fine until about halfway down, and the wind started getting quite bad, and I think I took a wrong turn. The visibility was shit. Before I know it, I'm doing a tree run, completely off the trail. It was fine for a while, but just when I thought I might be able to get out of there, I kind of fell into a tree well. Aziraphale groaned in horror and rubbed his face. Looking, if possible, even more guilty, Crowley kept going. Luckily it wasn't that deep, and I went in feet first. Still, I had to unstrap the board to crawl out and just leave it there. By the time I found the groomed track, it was nearly sundown. And I kind of just decided that I had to hike back to the car, which I did. So, here we are. He sniffed quietly. Feeling the tension beginning to rise again, Harriet stepped forward. That was very stupid, but I'm glad you're all right. Are you all right? Demanded Aziraphale sharply. You didn't get hurt, did you? Bones, frostbite? All in one piece, Angel, promised Crowley with uncanny softness. Just exhausted, really. You're lucky it was just that, Aziraphale said icily, though his tone was not making it secret that Crowley would need a fair bit more fortune to keep it that way where he was concerned. As if sensing this, Harriet stepped in again. She petted Aziraphale's arm soothingly and then suggested they both get upstairs, since Crowley still looked very cold after his winter hike. There weren't many options left except to relent, and soon they were alone in their section of the cottage again, having been promised that their dinner would be brought directly to the room. Crowley, for all the worried glances he was throwing in Aziraphale's direction, was shockingly unwilling to stray too far. Maybe he was afraid that he would get yelled at again, or maybe Aziraphale looked worse than he thought. He certainly felt bad enough, after the complete lack of sleep the night before, and the unplanned grip of terror that evening. He was looking forward to rolling into bed more than he'd looked forward to anything since the beginning of their trip. Go get changed, said Aziraphale after they shuffled into the bedroom. I'll run you a hot bath. You're almost certainly going to catch a cold after that little field trip. I can do it myself, came the expected protest. But Aziraphale cut him off with a series of impatient tuts and dismissive gestures. Realizing he was not in a position to argue, the man slunk off towards the suitcase to shed his clothes. Aziraphale, meanwhile, headed to the bathroom to fill the tub. On the one hand, it had been a bit of an overreaction. Not in the sense that Crowley hadn't been in danger, he definitely had been. Tree wells were the leading cause of death on mountains. But in how he reacted upon his return. Certainly grabbing the man and attempting to break all his ribs on the front step wasn't the most lucid of his ideas, but Aziraphale hadn't been functioning on logic, and certainly kissing the said man was not entirely a paint-by-numbers idea either, but at least he could disguise it under some half-baked excuse of keeping up appearances for their marriage. Though that, too, was a good cover-up as pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. He hadn't been thinking about anything at all. Fear, relief, intense joy had driven him to be some sort of mad animal craving the emotional catalyst of physically feeling Crowley in his arms, proving to himself that it wasn't a hallucination, that everything really was going to be okay. But if it hadn't been, what would have he done then? Not him. His mind echoed unhelpfully. It had been a frantic prayer, the most truthful one he'd done in years. Anything you can take, but don't take him. All right, Crowley said softly from behind him. Aziraphale jerked his head out of his hands, where he'd been cradling it as he leaned over the edge of the bathtub. He must have looked like he'd been asleep, sitting on the floor droopily. Yes, he mumbled. Get in. Crowley's footsteps approached, but nothing else happened.
So Xerophil deigned to raise his eyes and found himself staring at a modesty towel wrapped around the man's middle. Crowley said eloquently by way of an explanation. On any other day, at any other hour, Xerophil would have cared. But not today. Not now. He was beyond it. He was too tired, and whatever part of his mind was responsible for whatever it was he was usually so scared of, it was not currently functioning. "Nothing I haven't seen before," he said and glanced back at the tub, reaching to turn off the tap. There was an awkward clearing of the throat, then silence, and then the towel dropped to the floor. Another second, and Crowley stepped over the edge of the tub and sank into the hot water with a low but satisfied hiss. "Trying to boil me alive?" he asked. Xerophil snorted. "What for? Your skin and bone." "Lean meat," countered Crowley. "Gabriel would be proud. He's been trying to convince me to go on a diet for ages." At that, there was an indignant splash, and the voice cracked. "No, that's not what I... Fuck that guy, Angel. You know that's not..." "Hush, I know," breathed Xerophil tiredly, and flopped his arms into each other across the edge of the tub, sliding down a bit to pillow his chin on top of them. His eyes made their belated move to Crowley, skimming the edge of the water where his knobby knees made their modest appearance like two islands rising out of the sea. Beyond them, the border of his chest rose up, a scattering of rust-colored chest hair sneaking its way up nearly into the collarbones. The slope of his shoulders, elegant and sharp, angling wayside, their border broken just slightly by the tips of hair that hung down from his face. It was less curled than usual, having survived quite the ordeal inside a hat, and clung to the shape of Crowley's skull in mute protest. With his glasses off, he seemed even more defenseless, sharp cheeks and nose, and sharp teeth gnawing at the inside of his mouth, and sharp chin jutting out stubbornly towards his ear veil. "You look like death warmed over," said Crowley. Xerophil snorted. "You're one to talk." "I'm fine. No need to fuss," Crowley muttered. "I'm not fussing."
"You are."
"You should sleep. You don't have to wait here. I'm sure you're tired of me."
With a deep breath, Xerophil lifted his eyes to the gold ones again.
"Crowley," he said quietly,
seemingly eager to end another bout of awkward silence. Crowley sucked in a breath through his teeth and squinted at the water.
"Right, so, change of topic. Did you see the,
It was more than enough to make himself understood, as Xerophil had practice.
"The coat?"
"Yes, of course.
I'm beyond grateful, Crowley. It's perfect."
He wasn't made of stone. He couldn't help the recurring flare of fond gratitude. "But changing the subject won't let you off the hook." Crowley slipped a little further down into the water, preliminary guilt eating away at his expression right before he shoved his hands over his face, rubbing at his eyes. He held them there, but when his ear failed, said nothing else. A panic lever seemed to trigger a flight or flight instinct, which, in Crowley, manifested as talk or walk. He chose to talk, rapidly.
"I'm sorry,"
he began again, nerves crackling between words.
"I know it was stupid. I know I wasn't thinking. I wanted to do something semi-foolish, and I wanted to get some sort of rush. I needed to get out of the house and get some fresh air. I didn't think about the weather, and I didn't plan, and I didn't make good choices, and I know I ended up jeopardizing your trip."
"My trip?" The ricochet was so strong, Crowley froze instantly and finally looked up. In front of him, Xerophil was sitting up straighter. "My trip.
he repeated, incredulous. Is that what you think this is about?
Crowley blinked. He said. Isn't it?
Channeling the eternal, meditative patience that had gotten him through Mass many a time, Aziraphale took a deep breath. He lifted his eyes to the heavens, tried to think of something to say, and failing that, simply went with,
Lord, give me strength.
Crowley sank a few inches deeper into the water.
Aziraphale.
Not letting him finish, Aziraphale held up a hand and then pushed on the edge of the tub and heaved himself to his feet. Anthony J. Crowley. He began in what was his softest and most terrifying voice. Although it is true that I had many goals in undertaking this journey, losing your company to a quick and untimely death was not one of them. So book deal or no, I would prefer you keep yourself alive, if only for my sake. Sloshing the water out of the tub a bit, Crowley curled tighter around himself and looked stubbornly anywhere but up.
Of course, he mumbled. For your sake, yeah.
Thank you. Aziraphale sighed and pivoted on his foot, waddling to the door. He pulled it open and was about to exit when Crowley made a noise behind him. Turning to follow it to the source, he found the man had tipped his head back on the edge of the tub and was staring at the ceiling.
So,
he said, and he cleared his throat awkwardly.
Am I sleeping on the couch tonight?
Aziraphale regarded him quietly. No, he said, finally pursing his lips. You're sleeping next to me, where I can keep an eye on you lest you get another one of your urges to run off unaccompanied into the wilderness. In reply, Crowley simply went red and made some sort of acknowledging noise. As this was good enough for Aziraphale in his current sleep-deprived state, the author said nothing else and exited the bathroom. He ate dinner by himself, most uncharacteristically of all, standing in front of the balcony and watching the winter storm tear through the scenery like a rubber wiping out whole swathes of canvas. His mind was similarly affected, with large chunks of it either blurred with a storm of inexplicable emotional exhaustion and others having already been wiped completely clean. Did Crowley really think he was only worried about ruining their trip? Beyond simply being a ludicrous idea, any human life was absolutely more important than some bloody book. It also hinted at something much more concerning. A peek into Crowley's thinking process. A glimpse of how he'd constructed this entire scenario. To him, was Aziraphale simply in this for the money? For the fame? Did he assume his being here was nothing more than convenience? Did he truly think that, beyond a surface level of friendly cooperation, his presence in Aziraphale's life was a means to an end? Aziraphale stared through the glass, hands trembling acutely and biting his lip. Not for the first time, nor the last, he thought. You should tell him. But he couldn't. Not after everything else he'd already done. With Crowley having reacted so poorly the first time, who knew what would happen if they had another falling out? It was better, then, to wait until later. Maybe after this was all over, Aziraphale could confess. Bring it up, maybe over some wine. Maybe in a month, or a year when the wound wasn't so fresh. Oh, you remember that trip? He would say. The one we went on to America. And Crowley would say, I'd rather not. Oh, Aziraphale would say then, his mouth going dry. Of course. And Crowley would soften, maybe take pity on him. In this fantasy, he would not be driven away at this point. He would not hate Aziraphale, not yet. He would allow the other to dig the hole himself. allow him to open his mouth and say, "You know, it's a funny story, actually. The whole reason I asked you to come with me on that trip, you see, I never actually told you, my dear. It's because..."
Aziraphale snapped back to the present with a shiver. No, he couldn't do it. This was no daydream. He was not the hero of this story. He was the villain. The architect of a terrible plot. The Crowley in his mind, the one from the future, frowned. "Because what?" When Aziraphale didn't answer, he smiled sadly. "Just as well," the specter said. "People always assume we're together when we go to restaurants. Should at least put it to good use, am I right?" And then he would sip his wine, and Aziraphale would return once more to his own personal purgatory and say nothing. He would climb under the blanket and cover himself up to his head and close his eyes and hope that he might one day wake up braver than he was. The first time someone mistook them for a couple, and second technically, though he mentally reset the counter after Schrodinger's shag to make himself feel better. Aziraphale had the sense to act shocked and appalled. He had the sense to deny it, vehemently, with an awkward smile, waving his hands at the young customer and saying, "No, no, it's not. It's not like that at all. We hardly even know each other." Before all but pushing her physically out of his bookshop and closing the door. The third time, when the waiter made the assumption of not splitting their check, he refrained from making a show of protesting it loudly on reflex, if only to spare himself the ordeal of watching Crowley shrug into his shoulders and stare forlornly into the distance. The ninth time, when the barista said, "And anything for your boyfriend?" He merely glanced in Crowley's general direction, visually confirmed that yes, the man was still occupied with drawing little caricatures on the glass of the stock photo frames in the display case, and then recited to her a request for a soy milk caramel latte he'd memorized, completely on accident, of course. Eventually, when the attendant taking his coat at the opera check-in had said, "What about your, brother?" Aziraphale stared him down with such a look of offended disbelief that he immediately apologized and asked if they would like their things under the same token, to which Aziraphale replied primly in the affirmative. He had ignored the way Crowley seemed to glow at the edges for the rest of the night and wrote it off to the arts being underfunded and skirting on replacing overhead lights in the reception area. So yes, perhaps the pretending was not really a novel idea, but it was also clearly not a serious sentiment. They both knew there was nothing between them. It was just easier to go with the flow instead of outright denying it every single time. Besides, the sort of functions they showed up to rarely posed a risk of anyone identifying him. After his climb to fame in the greater literary community, they had taken to being more careful, limited their outings to being strictly at night, and to establishments that would not allow anyone to glimpse his face for too long. But by then, the habit was already well formed. It wasn't like it happened often, but when it did, they had an unspoken agreement to just accept it as a byproduct of their non-stop stream of soft bantering, and Aziraphale's reflex to correct Crowley's jacket collar whenever it was uneven, which was suspiciously often. And if it warmed Aziraphale on the inside and made him feel a little less lonely, well, Crowley didn't have to know that. Aziraphale's games of pretend couldn't hurt him. It was a victimless crime, a little white lie, an indulgence of the imagination for the few hours they would steal away as theirs. The only time Crowley ever said anything was when Aziraphale, following one of their late-night walks along the river, ducked into a pub and then began to lament wanting to see a midday concert in the park, only to immediately dismiss the idea outright for fear of being seen together.
I could go and drag, Curly had offered, only half-jokingly. Dust off the old heels. They're not that dusty. You wore them 2 weeks ago. Aziraphale replied without looking up from the menu. And no, I'm not about to stoop so low as to unwittingly reenact the birdcage for the sake of Mahler. Then you could just go without me, Crowley suggested. Aziraphale locked his eyes on a line in the dessert section and kept them there, biting down on the tip of his tongue. No, he said at last, with as much casualty as he was able to muster. Now that I'm thinking about it, I don't have time. I ought to be writing anyway. Crowley leaned back in his seat, looking too smug for Aziraphale's liking. What are you so busy with? Still haven't caught up on the deadline for a rework of the piece for the Traveling Light magazine. Is that the one you're not letting me touch? Crowley asked. The one from your week trip to Japan, about that little town that claims Jesus escaped the crucifixion and ran away to... where was it again? Omori. Aziraphale huffed. And yes, I'll handle it myself, thank you. Suppressing a chortle into his coffee, Crowley took pity and changed the subject. What about the others? You said you wanted me to add some flair to that short fiction piece, the one about St. Peter's Cross. Ah, yes, that one I do need help with. Mollified, Aziraphale emerged from behind his menu with a concentrated crinkle between his eyebrows. You're far better at spreading the philosophical butter than I am. I have a half-baked spiel about the symbology of inversion as it persists in Western settings and the dichotomy of inverted ideas in the general sense, but I'm rather at a loss of where to lead it. Am I allowed to delve into symbols of Levian Satanism as an exploratory side lecture? Or at least as recommended reading? What did I say last time? Aziraphale asked, giving him a pointed look. You said no. Then no. Aziraphale snapped the menu open again. Unless you want your modern Zorro ripoff to give up his vigilante lifestyle and develop a sudden interest in becoming a celibate monk. But then who would solve the mystery of the underground sex cult? Crowley pouted. And what about poor Alexandra? What would she do without him? Meet a more competent lesbian lover, Aziraphale replied. One who actually knows what Shibari is and doesn't assume the G-spot is spy code for an area with really good cell phone reception. There was a sputtering, choking down of startled laughter, and Crowley leaned forward, elbows on the table and chin cupped in his palms. You have the best ideas, he said with a smile that Aziraphale couldn't look at for too long. How will I ever repay you? Seeing the waiter approaching, Aziraphale closed the menu and wiggled in his seat, deciding it was his turn to look smug. You're going to order the salted caramel and chocolate tart so I can try it, because I can't decide between that and the Victoria sponge cake. After 4 years of coexistence in all manner of tiny bars and restaurants and backstreet cafes, perhaps it could be written off to habit. But he couldn't help but feel a spark of warmth when Crowley ordered both items obediently, and then tacked on an Irish coffee, which Aziraphale had been thinking of getting. It was pleasant to be appreciated, and he always felt warm under the sunshine rays of that sly, tempting grin when the man laid the compliments on thick. He could almost imagine that he was, for a brief and fleeting moment, indispensable. Of course, the feeling never lasted long. The night would end, they would part ways, and the fleeting fantasy of romance would dissipate into its real form as the stinging cold of realistic loneliness. When it came down to it, he knew he needed Crowley much more than Crowley needed him. He didn't know what time it was when he woke up, but it was not morning. Outside, the storm was picking up again, and the deck rail was nearly invisible in a flurry of white. Aziraphale watched it for a moment, wondering if that had been what woke him, but a stirring a few feet away proved otherwise. Crowley was moving somewhere on the opposite end of the bed. As Aziraphale's sleep-muddled mind caught up to the noises, he recognized them one by one. Shuffling, irritated huffing, and a continuous readjusting of blankets. Crowley flopped over onto his stomach and then tucked his face into his own pillow again. Through the cover of his eyelashes provided, Aziraphale could see his chest rising and falling. It wasn't entirely steady. Sometimes his breath would hitch, and then he would sigh impatiently. At one point, he reached down to scratch at something under the covers. A few times, he shifted himself onto his side, but then once more returned to his original position, face down on the mattress. Maybe it was an unpleasant dream, but there was something to the way Crowley was clenching his jaw, and the way he would hiss an aggravated sigh through his nostrils that hinted otherwise. He could have just let it go, could have rolled over and closed his eyes and fallen back into a much less interesting dream of his own. But he was almost rested for once, properly relaxed, and the darkness of the room was inviting and safe, and he missed Crowley. Missed seeing him like this, without the edge of awkward uncertainty bracketing their every move. The nighttime, as always, felt like a liminal space, felt like something not quite real, with fuzzy edges to contrast the sharp cut of daylight. Aziraphale found himself, inexplicably, missing that feeling. It was like the cover of a dimly lit bar and a back table where no one could see them. It was like the corner of an orchestra house, a back row where no prying eyes could spy their peaceful coexistence. It was safe darkness, taking them under their wing, hiding them, whispering, "It's all right, no one is watching. You can be yourselves here. There are no rules." It had been so simple, those 6 years. It had been painful, too. But at least they had their rituals. At least they knew what the limits were, what to do and what not to do. They had guidelines to follow and traditions to keep, and everything was, well, if not good, then at least tolerable, predictable. In contrast to that, these past few days, he felt like he'd been wandering around blind. He had his habit shaken loose. He had been given the reins to a cart with the horse already far behind it. He had been overwhelmed by the freedom of all his previous forbidden joys. He had gotten cocky. Perhaps he was Icarus. Perhaps the wings that he'd wanted for so long had allowed him to fly too close to the sun. Perhaps this would be his fall. A few feet away, Crowley sighed. His back was to Aziraphale, which meant he didn't have to close his eyes, didn't have to pretend to sleep. He could watch the way the red hair spilled over the pillow, the way the neck muscles jumped just a bit as the other dreamed, if he was dreaming, or shivering. "Are you cold?" thought Aziraphale. "Are you cold without me? Do you need me?" He wanted to be needed. At least if he burned, he could offer something, some semblance of warmth. Some good could come from his hubris, from his wretched dream of reaching a star he was never meant to approach. He could live with that. He reached out. Crowley stilled at the first touch of his hand on the back of his neck. He stilled, but he did not pull away, which allowed the courage Aziraphale was rationing to grow from a trickle into a stream. When he edged closer, Crowley slowly shifted back into him until eventually Aziraphale could put his arm around the other and draw him in, Crowley's back flushed to his chest. Their bodies fit together in a bittersweet, familiar way he thought he should not remember, but somehow did. He slid his hand around Crowley's waist, and the man's breath hitched. Aziraphale paused, reconsidered, began to draw back, but then there were fingers gripping his own, and Crowley was pulling him back and tucking himself with a sudden urgency against the soft shape of Aziraphale's body, spine to chest. For a few moments, they breathed together. Aziraphale's nose skimmed the back of his neck, his lips tickled by the stray hairs pinched there. Their fingers remained locked somewhere beneath the bedsheets. A hiss rattled its way nervously from between Crowley's teeth and he shuddered. It was a release of tension, some sort of wordless curse, some sort of unspoken blessing. Aziraphale had taken a chance, and he guessed correctly. Here, in the safe darkness of their bedroom, they had fit against each other, and everything, for one brief moment, was just as before. Just as it had been 6 years before everything had gone pear-shaped. Before there was anything to be afraid of, anything to regret. It was Aziraphale's turn to draw in a shaky breath. His lips parted, unbidden, and before he could quite understand what he himself was doing, he was pressing his mouth to the back of Crowley's shoulder. Crowley hissed again, louder. His fingers squeezed on Aziraphale's, a positive sign. But before Aziraphale could repeat the action, he was in motion again, writhing. Aziraphale's heart, ever ready for rejection, dropped and he let go. Only to find his arms full of Crowley again. Only now they were facing each other. They were barely a few inches apart. And Crowley's eyes were open. And fuck, his eyes were so open. Unguarded by glasses and by daylight. Unguarded and desperate and scared, uncertain. There was nowhere to run to. The storm was raging outside. They were both trapped here, and Aziraphale wasn't planning to let him out of his sight again anyway, not after what happened. What did it matter, really? What consequence did their actions have on that cold, unforgiving world? It didn't care about what they did under the cover of night. It didn't count their actions against a scoreboard and didn't tally up the points. They were here, and they were warm. And Crowley. Crowley was alive. Crowley was safe. Aziraphale. He breathed. The beginning of something. The start of some sentence. Some excuse. Some mindless babble about something he was most certainly making up in his anxiety-riddled brain. Aziraphale didn't want to hear it. When he moved, it was easier than he'd come to expect. There wasn't a wall he was breaking through, not gravity pushing back against him. On the contrary, it was easy to fall towards Crowley, magnetic. It was like he was possessed. If only he had such a simple excuse. Aziraphale's body already knew the destination. His fingers were already where he'd imagined them 1,000 times before, one hand cupping Crowley's jaw, one sliding to the back of his neck. In a single stretch, he closed the distance between them in a way he had dreamed of, imagined, over and over and over again. Until it was as natural to him as breathing. Crowley made a noise. It was not one of surprise, but instead a desperate thing, a whine of hope and need, and pitched forward into his path. Their mouths slid against each other, nervous and uncertain at first, and then harder, faster, hungry. Their hands were unwrapping and grasping again, fumbling for contact, and then they were there. There, clutching, slowly coming together, and then quickly, lips on lips, hands on hands, chests flush, legs tangling.
Shit.
Crowley gasped, and that was all he was allowed before Aziraphale kissed him again, more soundly this time, swallowing the high-pitched moan. It would have perhaps been taken as a bad sign, this noise, if Crowley wasn't writhing eagerly and swinging a leg over his hip with the determination of a man lost at sea who just discovered a boat in the middle of a storm. Aziraphale was responding in kind. His hand, the one that wasn't busy tangling up into Crowley's hair, was traveling downwards over the arch of his back, pushing up his sleeping shirt and sliding his fingers up the ribcage, getting at more skin. Crowley shoved himself against the other in kind, grabbing, gripping, as if he couldn't quite find the proof he needed that Aziraphale was actually there. His hands landed on Aziraphale's arse, and he broke away from their kiss to let out an incoherent string of syllables that sounded like the distant cousin of, "Oh, fuck, God, yes." It was only then that Aziraphale realized that the searing heat of want was not the only thing he was feeling in the pit of his stomach. No, lower, pressed up against the dip of his hip, was something hard and just as warm. Something that had clearly been hard for a while. Judging by the bit-off whine Crowley gave when Aziraphale sneaked a hand down between them and pressed his palm firmly against it.
"Who is this for?"
Aziraphale thought to himself, fingers moving carefully up to the waistband of Crowley's underpants.
"Is it me you were thinking of? Or someone else? Were you merely having a good dream?"
He didn't want to ask, didn't want to know the answer, didn't want to risk knowing the truth. It was enough that the man was reacting positively, jerking his hips towards his touch, moaning open-mouthed against his neck when Aziraphale closed his fist around the base of the erection and rolled his thumb across the head that was already wet with pre-cum. Whatever it was Crowley had been imagining during his brief tossing and turning on his side of the bed, it had already taken its toll. With every drag of Aziraphale's steady fingers up his cock, he keened obscenely and twisted his face into Aziraphale's neck to mouth at his jaw. And Aziraphale responded in kind, biting his own lips until they bruised to contain the noises of delight that were bubbling out of him. In a burst of confidence, he even pushed his own pajamas down his hips, and then rolled them over until their erections slid against each other, hiking Crowley's legs up over his hips, and then looking, belatedly, to Crowley himself for a reaction. The reaction appeared to be overwhelmingly positive, because Crowley, red-faced and practically melted into the mattress, bit his bottom lip and stifled an obscene cry which may or may not have been the word, "Please." As Aziraphale's grip settled around his base again, they both let out a grateful pair of moans. And Crowley shoved himself impossibly closer, as if he couldn't get enough. He snaked an arm around his neck and sent another skidding down Aziraphale's chest until he found the thick erection already waiting there for him, impatient and practically shaking with need. It didn't take too long, not with his smart fingers on the job. And it helped that Aziraphale was already plenty hard and swelling more every second that Crowley worked on him. They rocked against one another, somehow in sync, and mouths slotting together for a brief, blissfully warm kiss before Aziraphale pressed him harder into the mattress and thrust against his erection again. Crowley fisted his hair and his mouth parted seemingly on its own.
"Angel,"
he rasped, low and needy and undone and familiar, just like in every one of his fantasies, only better. What little remained of Aziraphale's precious self-control was straining, threatening to rip. Crowley, as if an echo to his inner storm of need, to his quickening hand, arched up off the bed, the curve of his throat just under Aziraphale's mouth. He pressed another soft kiss into it, soothing, and then gave another firm stroke, responding to the building cries Crowley was trying to stifle, rather unsuccessfully, into the back of his hand held over his mouth. With their bodies zipped close, he felt, rather than saw, the orgasm pulse through the other. There was a lovely point of tension when Crowley's cries pitched into silent gasps, and then he shuddered. And the threads holding him together came undone again as the wave of pleasure crested.
Aziraphale,
he moaned, a barely contained sob. It was too much, and, overcome with the bright, hot need, Aziraphale slid his hand to himself and finished in merely a few seconds, stifling a loud moan of his own into Crowley's shoulder. They pulled back just an inch, panting into each other, and Crowley's eyes caught his for a moment.
Fuck,
Crowley whispered, and Aziraphale felt that he rather agreed. Not now, he told himself immediately before he could open his own stupid mouth and add to the already adequate observation. Don't ruin it. He tipped his forehead against Crowley's, closed his eyes, and waited for the warm, rolling aftershocks to give him control of his brain back. His whole body was glowing, and even with the desire abated, he couldn't quite remember why they hadn't done this much, much earlier. There must have been a reason, he knew, but with Crowley pressed up against him, he couldn't for the life of him recall what the hell it had been. Finally, the window shuddered under the weight of the gale again, and the chill they'd been impervious to a few moments prior made itself known. Aziraphale sighed and rolled over, reaching for the bedside table where a box of tissues was waiting. Here, he said quietly, handing Crowley some and wiping away the evidence from his own stomach. As soon as he was done and had tossed it in the direction of the rubbish bin, he was rolling over and feeling as if a heavy, warm weight had settled over him, because in fact it had. Crowley snaked an arm around his chest, and he found himself pinned rather comfortably in the middle of the blankets. There was probably a reason to care. There was probably something to be said about this, but Aziraphale felt, for once in his life, utterly incapable of recalling all the facts. His brain was blissfully empty, and the only thing he thought as he turned his head and pressed his nose against Crowley's hair was how they would have to wash the bedsheets in the morning. Outside, the wind kept howling, and the frost scaled the cottage, conquering, bending the trees to its will. But neither of them heard it at all, because they were already fast asleep. The end of part 8.